Release the hounds!
PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert. And welcome to The Bunker. We have a brand new edition. And this one isn't a computer.
No. It's a little more crowded in here today. We've got a new edition. She's all of about, about a pound and a half?
Oh, I don't know. She might even weigh 2 pounds, honey. She's about 8.5, 9 weeks old, and she's tough.
Yeah, her name is Java. She is, what is she?
She's half Java the pup.
It's a new puppy. She's part...
She's half Yorkie and half dachshund.
Ah, half wiener dog.
Yes.
And Murphy says, hey, that's my job.
Well, I'm the boy. Come on.
Yeah, after the op... Well, we won't go
well,
there.
Well, yeah.
Well, it is Tuesday, February 21st, and it is just about 7 o'clock Central Standard Time, 0100 Greenwich Mean Time on the 22nd, and, kind of a red-letter day in our lives as well, another milestone passed today.
Yes.
Yes. Our daughter is now legal to drive.
Ah!
Well, of legal age.
Of the age to become legal to drive. She said she wants to wait a little bit on that, so we're going to see how that goes. But we're having a whole bunch of teens over here on Saturday, so if we sound a wee bit frazzled come Monday,
you'll know why.
Puppyhood and partyhood.
Yeah, so it's going to be an interesting week. In more ways than one, today we begin the first of a three-part interview with Scott Stevens. Weatherwars.info is his website.
That interview is so interesting. He is a personable, just pleasant. It was a joy to talk to him.
Yeah.
And, very informative. He knows his stuff.
That's true. We talked chemtrails. We talked weather modification, weather control. Mm-hmm. And we talked the purpose of the New World Order or the Illuminists or whatever you want to call them in controlling our weather. What do they hope to achieve and gain through this control? But we'll take a look at a couple of items in the news before we pardon us while we sit and watch here. Java is busy wrestling with a stuffed frog.
We'll post pictures of Java as soon as she is still long enough for us to take one.
Yeah. Even with a fast shutter and the digital camera. In the news, the big thing today is the furor that has erupted over the sale of control of the ports, those six ports, to Dubai Port World.
You know, it amazes me that the mainstream media has actually picked up on this. Mm-hmm. And somewhere along the line, someone decided we can get him on this one.
Yeah, I think so.
But George Bush came out today and he said, anybody, any of you guys,
touches my nomination.
Exactly. He said, no, this is going through.
Yeah, George Bush, for the first time, I don't think he has vetoed any piece of legislation that's crossed his desk in 5 years?
You know, nothing that comes to mind, but he's definitely putting his foot down on this one and saying, this is going to happen. And guess what we found out?
Well, it's very interesting that the company that to whom control of these ports has been sold or is in the process of being sold, it hasn't been approved yet, Dubai Port World, is the company from which a chief executive named Dave Sanborn was nominated last month to become the new director of the Maritime Administration for the United States. Basically, the guy who controls the merchant marine and how that's governed by the U.S. government. He wasn't with Dubai Port World for very long.
No.
He joined the company in 2005, and then here he is in the first month of 2006 being appointed to take over the control of the merchant marine in U.S. ports.
Right, and there is a press release that we've linked to from WatcherMagazine.com. Press release where Dubai Port World is talking about this guy like, oh, he's one of our favorite people. We're almost like he's a favorite son.
We've known him for years. He only worked here for 6-7 months.
Proud of him going on. There is something so stinky about
Well, these six ports are not small little refuges from the storm. We're talking the passenger ship terminal at Manhattan, the Port Authority terminal in Newark, which is, of course, the controlling government authority for the World Trade Center,
mm-hmm.
Philadelphia's port, the Port of Baltimore, the Port of Miami, Florida, and the Port at New Orleans.
These are huge ports. And apparently the governors of some, if not all of these states, mm-hmm. have gotten together and said, we don't like this.
Yeah, and many of those governors are Republican, as are many of the senators and representatives in Congress who are standing up to say, no, this is not a good idea. We don't want this to fly. But again, the president said, if you pass a law to prevent this, I will veto the legislation.
You know what scares me? I'm on Chuck Schumer's side.
Yeah, I know. That really is a disturbing place to find ourselves. So anyway, we'll see what happens with this tempest in a teapot. But what's really curious is that George Bush is taking such a strong stand on this. And we tried to do some digging into Dave Sanborn's background to find his resume, his bio, something. And all we can find is that he seems to have had a pretty steady career. Got a degree from the Merchant Marine Academy and has held a number of executive posts with companies involved in container shipping and ports.
Well, so far all we see is a bachelor's degree.
Yeah.
Which is unusual for a position this high.
You would think.
Usually you have an MBA or something.
You would think. And again, the strange connection between the company he's coming from, although I would guess it's a pretty small field, I would imagine there aren't a whole lot of companies out there that manage ports of these, you know, this size. But still, that he would come from that, you know, company less than 2 weeks ago mm-hmm. as the administrator for the Maritime Administration, and then for that company then to win this big contract.
So, what a coincidence.
Yeah, it does seem a little odd. I hate feeling this suspicious about stuff.
I know.
Connected to our government. Something else that popped up in the news today, which UPI reported on and was posted promptly to Watcher Magazine. An emergency supplemental appropriation bill for the war on terror, that $72.4 billion extra that we needed for the war on terror.
Well, you know, there are a lot of Kleenexes and bandages and things that we
have
to pay for. Hammers,
toilet lids.
Toilets, yeah.
Is nearly $500 million worth of military construction and about $35 million in new money for the National Security Agency to, you know, expand their top secret listening post, which is in Yorkshire, England, by the way, and the authority to spend $700 million that was set aside in previous budgets to construct or expand NSA facilities in Georgia and Hawaii.
Okay. Our NSA's mm-hmm. primary listening post
yeah.
is in Yorkshire, England?
That is correct. Menwith Hill is the name of the location. And $35 million has been
Men
set aside.
Men with Secrets should be the name
yeah,
of the
exactly.
location.
So, and this was tucked away in this special emergency appropriations bill. $35 million to expand the NSA's listening post in England, but then the authority to spend $700 million, which has apparently been frozen, to expand other NSA facilities elsewhere. So while the Congress is busy debating whether or not they're going to hold hearings on the NSA's secret spying program, the president just sort of jammed through in this emergency appropriations bill money to expand the NSA's operations.
You know, why do I get the feeling I'm watching a magic act?
Mm-hmm. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Yeah, well, along that same line, a story that we also had on Watcher Magazine today, you know how during the State of the Union address, President Bush happened to slide in there that little strong suggestion, that the medical savings account mm-hmm. Law be expanded.
Right, right.
And that we improve upon that and make that an even bigger allotment.
Well, it sounded like a good idea.
Which you and I thought, that's great, because you and I have a medical savings account.
Right.
It's great. It's pre-tax dollars.
Mm-hmm.
There's a possibility that what he's really going for is to make it possible that the businesses no longer have to pick up your health insurance.
Yeah, it basically offers an incentive for employers to just quit offering health insurance to their employees, small businesses especially. Big businesses can still buy in enough quantity to get discounts from insurance companies, but smaller employers, like the company I work for,
yeah.
we've got only a couple dozen people.
Right.
It wouldn't make sense for our employer to keep offering insurance. They could just say, hey, look, now you've got a $10,000 annual limit in the health savings plan, mm-hmm. medical savings plan. Why don't you just put your money all in there?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I
mean, well, you and I talked about this at lunchtime. If you're working for a small business that is picking up the tab mm-hmm. for your health insurance, that's a big shift
mm-hmm.
because that's a big perk.
Yeah, it is.
To your income. If suddenly you have to pay for your own by putting money into a health medical savings account, yeah, it's pre-tax dollars,
mm-hmm.
but it's still a loss. It's a net loss
right.
on your income.
Right. Now, a lot of companies, a lot of employers, such as mine, have been forced, really, to start shifting some of the cost to their employees anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And really what it amounts to is a hidden tax or a hidden pay cut.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my gross salary has increased, but because of the added cost of the insurance that we now have to pay for,
mm-hmm.
that was covered, was offered as a bonus, you know, when I first started there. it works out to be just about a net gain of zero.
Well, yeah, but you know, at the same time, putting on a different hat. Gilbert House LLC, it's just really just you and I mm-hmm. actually in the company, but let's say we had five employees, which mm-hmm. we don't. We can hire the dogs. Let's say we had five employees. It would be a burden on us to try to provide health insurance
for
them. So this actually, from our viewpoint as employers, would be a great deal.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a tricky one, and we'll see how he manages to get this going, but if indeed that's his ultimate plan... well,
yeah, the way a couple of analysts have looked at this, basically by offering this health savings plan where you can now contribute up to $10,000, it offers people who already make a good chunk of money a tax shelter where they can hide 10 grand a year
mm-hmm.
tax free. I mean, in pre-tax
yeah.
dollars. Again, that's the key. It's pre-tax. There's nothing that comes out of it, and you can spend it. You know, as long as it's on medical bills.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, if you could roll it over into the next year, then maybe
that would be a great deal.
There were no limit to the amount that you could have in there. Well, we'll see how that ends up going.
Yeah.
One more thing I wanted to mention, and that's the whole alternative fuel thing.
Mm. Yeah,
does
what
he
is
have
that
some
all about?
Sort of big secret up his sleeve?
I don't know. I mean, we saw this on the news yesterday talking about we're on the verge of technological breakthroughs that would stun most Americans. What's his secret? Is this like his secret plan to
anti-gravity that he's pulling out of?
Yeah,
his hat.
It reminded me of the secret plan to get out of Vietnam. You know, I have here on this list of known communist sympathizers. Yeah, can we see the list? Yoink.
Now, exactly how many are in there?
It's Sawgrass. That's the secret. It's Sawgrass. Well, alternative fuels. Often are made of things that grow out of the ground. This is a really awkward segue, but it's the best I can come up with. And stuff that grows depends on the weather.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the weather guy, with weatherwars.info, Scott Stevens.
Well, welcome to our guest line in the bunker, a fellow that we've wanted to talk to for quite some time, and we're really pleased to have him with us. Scott Stevens, who is a graduate of the University of Kansas, and a professional meteorologist, spent many years working for KTKA in Topeka, RFD Television, KJRH Tulsa, WRGB in New York, and KPVI-TV.
That's a lot of letters.
That's a lot of letters.
In Idaho. Scott Stevens, weatherwars.info. Welcome to PID Radio.
Glad to be here.
So, Scott, have you been through the entire alphabet with your letters yet, or...?
No, but the full complement of network stations, ABC, then CBS, and now NBC. So
wow.
All the way through them all.
That's impressive for a Midwest guy.
You just have to. And moving around and slowly growing your salary as you change markets, mm-hmm. that's just kind of how the beast works.
That is
the opportunity to work at all of them.
That is true. My friends used to joke that they had a separate address book just for me. I had five different states in 5 years after college.
Try having the 401 keep up with that.
Exactly.
Oh, forget that. No, that's why you just put it in your mattress and go.
Which is tough when you've got inflatable mattress. But
I know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Scott, you recently left the career in television to pursue your research full-time into weather control and weather modification. What led you to that decision?
Ooh, Katrina ultimately did that. Just a lot of attention last summer as we dealt with another year of frequent hurricanes. And I worked with and did a radio show called The Science Detective with Richard Heaney out of California. And Richard had been working on it on a different aspect of the electrical and the magnetic processes within nature. And his discovery was that all rotating storms create an electrical or a magnetic field from the dust devil all the way up through the hurricane. And I was on his show, and we discussed a lot of the similarities. And Richard was kind enough to call one of the press wires, and that just kind of brought the whole incident into the front pages of USA Today, and then I did Lou Dobbs and CNBC. And so we got a lot of attention, which is probably a little more than the TV station wanted.
Mm.
So I ventured on my own after that.
Okay.
But it's been necessary, and I think the only way we're going to get people aware of what's going on weather-wise is to put a little information out there and to spark their curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
Teach them what to look for in the skies,
mm-hmm.
and they'll begin that own little sense of discovery and research on their own. And that's just the best way to get converts to this side of the story of what's going on, that weather modification, if not outright control, is not only a possibility, but that it has been accomplished in quite some time ago. And we're just living in that gray zone between when the weaponry was deployed and when realization among the public masses finally comes to fruition. And we're very close. We're very close to that second goal.
Now, when you say weaponry, what are you talking about?
We have to go back to World War II to kind of dig into the history of what has led us to the situation we find in the world today. And that during the early 40s, Joseph Stalin, the Soviet dictator, through his intelligence services, his spies that were here in the States, got wind of the Manhattan Project, which was our atomic bomb-building program.
Mm-hmm.
And that intelligence went back to him. And he basically said, we will match the Americans bomb for bomb. We will shadow that program and keep up with them. But then he also launched another program. And he said to his scientists, get me something different. Get me something that the Americans don't have. And that began first a whole lot of research and literally boatloads of documents, scientific literature and papers and theses and theories came over from Western universities and from our national labs, some of it stolen and some of it was in the public domain. And then they sat down through the documents looking for theoretical mistakes, incorrect assumptions. They began looking for flaws within the scientific journals, and they found those flaws and then developed ways to exploit them. The discovery of the ether, this orgon energy, this ether that permeates the entire universe, and they found how to exploit that energy. And those are flaws within the laws of thermodynamics that our Western science, even though we've had corrections and published for 100 years now, mainstream Western science still adheres to these flawed theories. And hence, we are largely ignorant to what, let's just say, mechanical forces are at work in the universe,
mm-hmm.
that the additional dimensions, all of that stuff science now is ignorant of, at least mainstream science, that is.
You know, a lot of the stuff you just talked about sounds like Nikola Tesla.
And he was, without question, a pioneer into this research. He developed the first scalar interferometer, where you can literally vibrate energy from the ether and then have it manifest into this realm, into this world. And vast amounts of energy are available to be used. And that's one of the really struggles that mainstream atmospheric scientists and physicists in general struggle with, is where does the energy come from to affect change in the weather/climate systems. And, I mean, we're bathed in this seething energy that is just a gift of creation, and yet science is just too blind and arrogant to acknowledge that this work, these corrections, have already been done. They're too busy protecting their turf. And anyway, Stalin came along in the 1950s with these scientists, and this program of energetics was born. And it is the use of developing space-time waves, longitudinal EM waves, or scalar waves, as Lieutenant Colonel Bearden calls them in his work. and it is how to use these space-time waves to set up resonances. You can set up resonances within the crust of the Earth to affect earthquakes. You can send out pulses within the oceans to create tsunamis or giant waves. And then you can turn the energy way down and affect changes within the atmosphere. What is curious about these waves is that they are bidirectional and that they also do not weaken with the distance traveled from the transmitter. So as radio waves, Hertzian waves that we utilize, we know the radio transmitter sitting out there on a hilltop, say 50 miles away. You get 100 miles away, and that signal strength is one quarter that it was at half the distance closer. These space-time waves, these scalar waves, do not attenuate. They do not weaken as they pass through matter or the distance increases from the transmitter. So they're at full strength when they achieve basically their location over the target. And that allows them to do a great deal of work. And over the top of, say, a hurricane, if you extract heat out of the tops of the clouds, these cloud tops will cool. And as the cloud tops get colder, then that increases the updraft from the warmer layers of the atmosphere below, and that strengthens the storm. Whether the desired result is just more snow out of a snowstorm, is severe thunderstorms and hail out of a thunderstorm, or eventually a tornado, all of these things can be achieved. And the Russians began experimenting with this in the 1960s, 40-some years ago. And it was Colonel Bearden's staff that finally alerted the executive branch to this program in the middle 1980s. The military was aware of it, but they had not let that information cross the military boundary into the civilian government. And no doubt the executive branch then, I don't know whether they've shared it with the congressional side or not, but they have to be aware of it on some level within the intelligence briefings that the Senate and House members get that are privy to that information stream. But
well, it's interesting you mention that. While you're talking about this, I was doing a quick look up on the web for a bill that was introduced into the Senate by Senator K. Bailey Hutchinson, Senate Bill 517, which was on Weather Modification Research and Development Policy Authorization Act of 2005, submitted to the Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation. She received a letter from the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy on December 13th, and I'm looking at the PDF right now. They basically asked Senator Hutchinson to defer further consideration of the bill until the Office of Science and Technology Policy can coordinate a discussion with the Departments of Justice, State, and Defense.
The bill is about weather modification.
Yeah, to create a program. Yeah, to create a program to study it. But they want to discuss the political and legal ramifications, and also the obviously the defense ramifications.
Which would be immense.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about liability. If you've enhanced a drought or steered a hurricane or created a hailstorm, I mean, this is not an area we should be messing with, especially not with the military involved.
Yeah. So, global implications in all areas of foreign policy, national security, commerce even, shipping, transportation. So I'm you're right, I think, Scott. I think that this is something that our government is aware of, just isn't talking about publicly very much.
There was one aspect of that bill that was called the technology transfer aspect of it. And that was kind of just left out there hanging. Where does the technology come from and where does it go? Is there going to be public oversight of the inner workings of this particular committee?
Mm-hmm.
And those were minor but significant wording changes that happened before the bill was passed. So there's some rumblings. There's some rumblings within the government that realizes, all right, people are becoming aware. The technology hasn't matured to the point to where it can be elevated to a cabinet-level position. I mean, we don't want to put it under FEMA's hands. My goodness. That would be a disaster then and there, or even Homeland Security. And I have a feeling that as we move through the remainder of this decade that the National Weather Service will likely be moved over from Department of Commerce and into Homeland Security. That'll be a significant change, but I think that's where it's going. I
mean, you know, it seems to me that sorry to interrupt. It seems to me that if the technology exists to extract energy from the atmosphere and create a self-perpetuating wave, that it would the application would be more than just weather modification.
Oh, entirely. If and when we finally get science to acknowledge the existence of this energy, this ether, I mean, one cup of this matter has enough energy contained within it to boil this planet's oceans. So using this continuously since 1976, as they have been with weather modification, you have to not wonder how much of that additional energy has accentuated the warming that we're seeing on this planet. How much heat, how much in the way of droughts has been added to this planet's ecosphere to combine with the carbon dioxide, combined with the methane, combined with the extra solar output from the sun that has led us to these rapidly melting glaciers up in Alaska, British Columbia, Greenland, Antarctica, and so forth. You know, so I think we've got a lot of things combining their forces that we as a humanity, as a civilization, are going to have to contend with and confront very, very soon, because admittedly, this administration is willfully disregarding the environmental crisis that we're facing. They just will not discuss it at any cost.
Let me ask you an even bigger question regarding that.
Mm-hmm.
I recently read, and I don't know what you think about this or if there's anything to it, but I recently read that Chandler's Wobble is disappearing.
I had read that, too.
Does that mean that the Earth's core is somehow affected?
It slowed down or stopped entirely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there was an article that was published in New Scientist, and I have not completed reading it yet, but I did repost it on my front page, and in amongst with three other articles. But, you know, there are things happening with this Earth, and we have been told there will things that will happen to this Earth that will be dramatic. Would that be an understatement?
No, I think that's quite an understatement.
You know, and I think piece by piece by piece, we begin to get a picture of what will unfold at some point in our probably rather near future.
I think so, too. Could you explain just briefly, since we brought it up for our listeners, what Chandler's Wobble is?
It is, well, I don't know if I have got the exact definition here, but the Earth, because there is fluid within the middle of it, and the interior rotates, and this fluid rotates at a rate separate from the hard crust on top of it, that there are wobbles, as there are different weights and masses on the surface of the planet, from oceans and atmospheric and cause, that we get a slight wobble within the magnetic field as those field lines protrude from the crust of the surface and into the atmosphere. And this Chandler's Wobble has been, I want to say, an under 2 year, I want to say 18, 19 month.
I think I've read 18 months, yeah.
Yeah, and that it is, and these, if I'm not mistaken, these were from Navy pages, too, where they follow these things. It had simply slowed down.
Mm-hmm.
My curiosity is how long before we see a manifestation in the crust?
Well, that is the big question, and my understanding is that it makes it appear, the wobble makes it appear that the North Pole is drifting.
And it has been accelerating in that drift.
Right, but, exactly.
You know, it's being driven from the Baffin Bay region of northeastern Canada, honestly, toward the actual physical North Pole and not towards the north and east. And then we've got that anomaly showing up, that magnetic anomaly in South Africa, which may be the new South Pole, but who knows?
In South Africa?
Oh, that's a new one on me. Could you expand on that?
Just that for the better part of two decades, there has been an anomaly, a magnetic anomaly underneath South Africa, and its intensity has not dramatically increased, but there has been a measurable increase in that intensity. And now you have to wonder if that isn't where the new pole is gradually gathering, and then we'll see our magnetic North Pole shifting towards Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
And if that is the case, then much of the United States would end up, after the flip, with lower latitudes, whereas the southern U.S. is like 30 latitude north and the northern U.S. is at 50. That may shift by 10 or 15 degrees farther south. and would put us in a far more temperate climate. But who knows what...
Excellent!
Excellent, as long as you're not along one of those coasts where they're going to just break off and... be fill along the bottom of the oceans.
We're in Missouri. We're okay.
I'm planting coffee.
You're planting coffee. I'll do bananas. there are a lot of things pointing to these changes happening soon. And climate-wise, these shifts have always happened inside of a human generation, less than 25 years, and sometimes as quick as 12 years. And in 1997, 1998, the shape of the Earth began to change. We had been going through the post-glacial rebound for the previous 10,000 years, where as the poles melted off their ice, the Earth began to spring and become more circular rather than squat at the equator.
Mm-hmm.
But 8 to 9 winters ago, that process abruptly reversed, and we began to... have compression at the poles, even with the water melting off of them. And what was determined was one of two things: that there were a volume of magma accumulating around the equator, or a volume of water that was not returning northbound within the ocean circulation. And it kind of determined that it has to deal with the ocean circulation. And this volume of water is 3 miles by 3 miles by 5 miles. So there's a lot of water that for the past consecutive 9 years has not been flowing northward in the Atlantic. And then a Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, in combination with another United Kingdom Oceanographic Institute, had laid buoys out across the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And they determined that this North Atlantic current was still healthy along the Western Atlantic, the Gulf Stream along the U.S. East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
But the return flow of this Gulf Stream along the coast of Portugal and also a little far out in the Atlantic, two of these streams had been reduced in volume, one by 30% and one by 50%. Then when they measured the return flow of the cold water descending from the North Atlantic along the bottom of the Atlantic, that there were several cases where these rivers of cold water had simply ceased, and some of them had even begun to back up. And that was because the water was not reaching critical densities, or it wasn't getting cold enough during the winter, Greenland, Iceland, Scandinavia, to then sink to the bottom of the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a function of our warmer winters up north and fresh water pouring off the ice.
Right.
So it's this freshening that in the past has caused our abrupt global climate change.
That's the plot of The Day After.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that
the Day After Tomorrow,
movie with Dennis Quaid?
Yep. And we may not end up in a Day After Tomorrow scenario, but there's no reason to say that it couldn't be year after next.
Well, that's a good place to break for today. And a very compelling tease ahead as we talk about what our government might or might not be doing to influence that change in the years ahead.
Yeah, in the meanwhile, as you wait for tomorrow's episode, assuming we make it to tomorrow, go to weatherwars.info, and you can check out Scott's own bio, and you can also look at the articles that he's been referring to, and you'll be ready for tomorrow.
As we continue our discussion with Scott Stevens of WeatherWars.info tomorrow on PID Radio.
Okay, that is the end of just part one with Scott Stevens. And, if you are coming away from this the way Derek and I did when we were talking with Scott, he's an extremely personable, interesting guy. And I look forward to talking with him again, so I'm betting that you are looking forward to part two.
Yes, I am, but and hopefully tomorrow we'll sound a little less distracted as
we've watched Java break the housebreaking rules once already during this.
Yes, and now she's
and we've been unable to do anything about it because we're tied to headsets.
Yeah, and Murphy is just standing here looking at us, saying, I could have told you.
Yeah, look,
I could have told
she's
you.
No good. She's leaking.
she's broken. Can you take it back and exchange it?
I told you not to give her any water. I warned you.
Well, part two of our interview with Scott Stevens is tomorrow. If you have any questions or comments on what you've heard today or anything that we talk about.
If you have any suggestions about dealing with a dachshund Yorkie mix, let us know.
Radio@peeringintodarkness.com.
You can also send us, join us on the forum at peeringintodarkness.com/forum. And until tomorrow, I'm Sharon Gilbert.
I'm Derek Gilbert. Thank you for listening to PID Radio.
Bye, everybody. Gonna step up to the microphone, say it loud and clear, a better day is